Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes, and we are joined by Ramesh Panuro, who is a senior editor of National Review Magazine and a columnist for Bloomberg Opinion. Thanks for coming in today. Appreciate it very much.
Glad to be here.
So you were one of the principled conservatives who were at the summit in Washington, D.C. this week. In fact, you were on the panel that I moderated. It was an interesting event, wasn't it?
I lived to tell about it. Yes, there were a lot of great speakers lined up. Unfortunately, I just had to duck in and out before doing a bunch of suburban dad things for the rest of the weekend.
Well, you made an interesting point that I saw quoted in one of the articles, because, you know, and then I had Heath Mayo on the podcast the other day, and I did ask him the question. I had your comments in mind. This is the problem, of course, of talking about principled conservatism, the implication that if you disagree with someone on social issues or on economic issues, that you are the principled one and the other one is not principled. And it is kind of dangerous to fall into that trap, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, I think that there is a general inability on all sides these days to be able to concede that intelligent people of goodwill might reach different conclusions than us on all manner of controverted issues. And I do think, you know, like you, I was somebody who has had strong objections to Donald Trump. And there's been a lot of sort of back and forth accusations of bad faith, and folks who fall into our general camp of being critical of Trump often, you know, at least sometimes, and maybe I'll soften it, sometimes suggest that that a vote for Trump or support for Trump is sort of per se dishonorable. And I think, you know, there are a lot of good people who have just reached different conclusions than we have.
Yeah, and you made it. You drew a pretty solid line, as I recall. And I had Matt Lewis on the podcast yesterday, and he was talking about his decision to vote for Joe Biden in the primaries. And of course, there was a lot of back and forth about whether or not principled conservatives could talk themselves into voting for Bernie Sanders. I don't think so, but others have a different point of view on that. You during your presentation drew a line on the issue of the right to life. I was interested that you chose that one to basically say that's where you're saying you can't cross that line.
Well, I do think that it is a basic issue of civil rights and human dignity, and I couldn't myself justify voting for somebody who was not willing to extend the protections of the law to unborn children. But, you know, I really think that a lot of this comes down to how one views the act of voting. And to my mind, I understand that there are a lot of people who believe, look, you've got two real options. The major party candidates, one of those people is going to win, and so you have to choose which of those people is preferable, even if they're deeply, deeply flawed, and vote for that person. Whereas I think the election actually doesn't come down to you. And if it did come down to you, if it was solely in the hands of your vote, then if we're going to vote on the basis of that fiction, then why can we not just have you vote for a third party person and say that person, if it came down to me, that's the person I would want to be president. So I really think that, in much of the time, a sort of a preferential view of who you vote for makes sense. But if you come to a place where neither of the major candidates you feel that you can vote for in good conscience, because there are some basic moral norms that they don't respect, for example, whether that be having presided over tearing apart families at the border or being against justice for unborn children, then I think that one can and should decline to be really sort of complicit in that kind of injustice.
So you don't buy the idea that every election is a Flight 93 election?
I don't. I think that is a way of creating a dramatic frame to make you overlook really some stirrings of conscience that you might otherwise have.
Let's talk about this week, the incredible dwindling Democratic field over the last few days. You know, pull the lens back. Even with the remove of a couple days, it is really amazing how this race turned around in about 72 hours. Can you remember anything comparable to it?
No, I mean, there are certainly examples of comebacks in primary campaigns.
Right.
One thinks, for example, of John McCain's campaign mm-hmm. rising back from the dead in 2008. But in this case,
John Kerry in 2004.
But in this case, the rapidity of it was really stunning. And it has been interpreted in some quarters as a sign that the Democratic establishment is more robust than the Republican one was in 2016, that it's able to coordinate and get weak candidates out. But the fact of the matter is the Democratic voters did a lot of this work. South Carolina's voters really made space for Biden as the anti-Sanders candidate and really destroyed the candidacies of Amy Klobuchar and Pete Buttigieg. And destroyed the rationale of the Bloomberg candidacy. And everything from that point on was really a ratification of the decision that those voters made.
Yeah, I think in general, everybody, when they talk about the establishment, they're talking about something that is that they're exaggerating. Because I remember back in 2016, you know, Trump was running against the Republican establishment. And of course, the joke was there really was no Republican establishment. It just doesn't exist. These parties are so small. But to the extent that there is a quote-unquote establishment, the Democrats do have something this time around the Republicans did not have. They have an ex-president who they still like. I mean, back in 2016, there was nobody in the Republican Party who had the popularity or the clout to do what Barack Obama may be doing behind the scenes. So that is kind of a difference between the Democrats this time and the Republicans 4 years ago. Do you think?
Yeah, I think that's right. And then there's something else which is worth noting, which is, you know, by the end of it, there were two candidates in the Republican field, Ted Cruz and Donald Trump, just as I think there is effectively, you know, Bernie Sanders and Joe Biden right now. But Ted Cruz was the more factional candidate between Trump and him. Trump really mm-hmm. was, in some ways, positioned in the center of the Republican Party, to the extent that John Kasich's voters had Trump as their second choice. They preferred Trump to Cruz. Cruz's voters preferred Trump to Kasich. In this case, Sanders is the more factional candidate, whereas Biden has always been positioned right in the middle of the Democratic Party.
No, that's a great point. I don't think you can overstate how loathed Ted Cruz was among fellow Republicans. I mean, he was, in many ways, he was the last Republican that was going to, you know, that Republicans were going to coalesce around at the last moment, whereas, Biden's much
easier. And so when Cruz won Iowa, the Iowa caucuses in 2016, the reaction mm-hmm. of, you know, Bob Dole and Trent Lott and John Boehner, was basically, either preference for Trump over Cruz or a kind of agnosticism. You didn't have the kind of rallying around you might otherwise have had.
Yeah, Satan. They regarded him as Satan. So, is it awkward writing for Bloomberg Opinion since we're about to talk about Bloomberg? I know you're asked about this.
Yeah, well, you know, it was actually more awkward last cycle because Ted Cruz is an old friend of mine and my wife was working for the Jeb Bush campaign, and Senator Rubio had adopted various ideas that I'd been promoting. So I had this sort of awkward disclosure that I had to link to all the time. This time, it's actually been a little bit less of an issue. The Bloomberg campaign was such a quick campaign. Mm-hmm. I don't think I ended up even writing about it except twice after Democratic debates. And in both cases, I was able to, you know, I just said, look, he did very poorly. And then later on noted that the rationale was had been destroyed. So no, the Bloomberg folks have always been exceptionally open to my point of view. I've written lots of anti-gun control and pro-life commentary for Bloomberg over the years without any trouble.
So let's talk about his campaign.
I haven't taken on the soda ban, but someday I will. It just hasn't come up yet.
That may be the line. You can write about guns, but when you defend Big Gulp, that may be it. So he's in for $600 million. He gets 6 delegates, and he's done. Doesn't win anywhere. So what is your take on this? Was this just a massive bust? Was it a bad idea? Was it an idea that almost succeeded? I saw some takes, people saying, look, you know, this is, it's easy to say that money doesn't buy you love in politics, but it actually came very close to happening. If, you know, certain things had broken different ways, this Bloomberg campaign could have transformed the election. So was it all a waste? Was it all a bust?
Well, I mean, I think the question, maybe the way to rephrase that is, was it crazy for him to do this? And I think the answer is, it was always unlikely to pan out, but it was not crazy. The strategy made a certain amount of sense, and had Biden proven weaker, and there was just sort of no way to know that until you actually put him to the test, it might have worked, right? I mean, he was there as a kind of insurance policy for moderate Democrats, mm-hmm. whatever moderate Democrats means nowadays, which is probably also something we should go into.
Yes.
In case Biden collapsed, and Biden might have collapsed. A lot of people thought he was collapsing, but it didn't happen. And then once it didn't happen, it no longer made sense. And, you know, one of the reasons why I would say this is sort of this was unlikely but not crazy is he's just got so much money that it doesn't, you know, I mean, it doesn't matter to him. He's not, you know, in no way is his living standard or, you know, his prospects affected by having made this race.
I mean, that is part of the problem, of course, is just the scale is just so hard to imagine because, as you point out, this doesn't even dent. I mean, we refer to Donald Trump as a billionaire. I mean, Michael Bloomberg could match Donald Trump's net worth by going through the change on his couch. I mean, it is that different. So what do you think he's going to do now? The interesting thing about Michael Bloomberg is that he can still play a significant role. And the fact that he immediately endorsed Joe Biden seemed to indicate that he's not even close to being done yet.
Yeah, I think that he is probably going to make good on the promises that he made all the way through this campaign, that he would continue to spend money to support the Democratic nominee. The only exception he made to that was in the case of, or his campaign made to that was in the case of Bernie Sanders, whose campaign manager said he didn't want the money, he didn't want the help in an election against Trump. So what that means between now and the Democratic convention, I am not sure about. My guess would be that Bloomberg will continue to run anti-Trump ads. But certainly in the fall, I expect him to be doing more sort of saturation buys.
Yeah, I want to go back to just something we were talking about.
Just advertising, but voter drives.
Right,
as well.
And data and right. And analytics. So moderate Democrats, it is interesting how the Overton window has moved this time, because we keep talking about the moderates in the race. And yet, by any historical standard, Pete Buttigieg and Joe Biden are running as really pretty solid liberals, progressives, to the left of where Barack Obama was running back in 2008 and even 2012. So the term moderate is a little bit of a misnomer, isn't it?
Right. Well, so politics is always in flux, and you know, there's no sort of stable ground on which to stand. But certainly the Obama of 2008 was not campaigning on weakening enforcement of the laws against illegal immigration the way Joe Biden, the moderate standard bearer, is today. Biden historically himself was against taxpayer funding for abortion. Of course, he reversed himself on that very early in this campaign. He is calling for, I believe, about $3 trillion worth of tax increases. So it is a very progressive left-wing campaign by historical standards.
So let's do you want to talk a little bit about some of the differences, the debates that conservatives are having? Because you are playing a very significant role in the question of economics. There's a group of conservatives that has formed that basically says, look, we need to get away from this fundamentalist orthodoxy of the free market, that we've been too focused on libertarian ideas about the market. We need to focus more on results, human flourishing. And there's a very robust and, frankly, I think principled debate going on there. And you've taken a strong stand.
Well, so I think that group that you're talking about, the folks who say that we've sort of gone overboard as conservatives in, as they would put it, sort of fetishizing or absolutizing free markets, I think they've got some reasonable points. But at the same time, I am very nervous about throwing out the baby with the bathwater. So yes, where there are excesses, they should be corrected. But markets, there's a lot of greatness in a market-based economic order. It's done a lot of great things for us. And fundamentally, our orientation should be how to make this work better, rather than trying to transform it. So right now, the way I would put it, so I spent several years, as you may know, arguing that the conservative agenda needed to be updated to address today's concerns. And so I was against a certain kind of free market fundamentalism, which acted as though sort of everything we needed to know we'd gotten in a stone tablet in 1981, and we never needed to have new thoughts. But more recently, over the last couple of years, I feel like we've sort of overshot the mark a little bit in the other direction. And so I think it's very important to explain, look, free trade is generally a quite good thing, and there are reasons we've adopted it. And there are it's not just sort of groupthink or corporate interests that are the reason why we tend to think that protectionism doesn't work.
Well, this is what's interesting, because you were among those who were sounding the alarms back when I think most conservatives were not really in a mood to rethink their position on all of this. You were one of those saying that, look, the base of the party is changing, and maybe some of these ideas have not been that effective. And your warnings were, I would say, ignored by Republicans until it was too late. Is that a fair assumption?
Well, Republicans were, I would say, slow to listen. And there were some powerful voices arguing on the other side of it. And I do think that one of the reasons why Donald Trump was able to win in 2016 in the primaries was because the old Republican agenda, and particularly the economic agenda, had just lost touch with reality and lost touch with the actual concerns of voters.
How did it do that? What was your critique?
So, for example, in 1981, one of Ronald Reagan's top economic objectives is bringing the top income tax rate down. And that makes a lot of sense in 1981. That top rate back then was 70%. And because of inflation and the way the tax code worked back then, people would be continually pushed up into higher tax brackets, even when they were standing still in terms of their actual living standard. And most people paid the income tax. Flash forward to 2012, and conservatives are still acting as though the income tax is one of the great problems in American life, and it's just as urgent to bring that top rate down, even though all of those circumstances are vanished. None of those any longer applies. You had in the middle of the beginning stages of the recovery from the Great Recession, you had Republicans warning about hyperinflation. And, we had double-digit inflation when Reagan took office, but time didn't stand still. We had actually extremely low inflation at that time when conservatives were warning about it. So conservatives were just sort of not talking about the issues that most voters were most concerned about. There was a set of concerns about higher education and the cost of housing, the cost of healthcare, where conservatives have had very little to say. What they've had to say has been almost purely reactive. There's no reason, I think, as a matter of principle, conservatives couldn't say, look, we didn't make most of the policies in these areas, and there are things we can do to improve the cost of living for people by applying market principles, but it couldn't just be a rote recitation of the old talking points.
Then where do you disagree with Trump's economic policies? Isn't his policy on trade specifically aimed to address some of those concerns?
Well, Trump's policymaking has been a mix. On the trade policy, I think that there is a kind of simple-minded protectionism. Now, I think that the threat of tariffs can make sense in some cases. And Trump is on his strongest ground when he's talking about a tariff campaign to bring China to the table and make China initiate reforms. But keep in mind that he started the trade war with China after imposing steel and aluminum tariffs mm-hmm. on just about everybody in the world with no real justification. Certainly the proffered national security justification of the administration makes no sense. And a real anti-China strategy, I think, would have involved a multilateral approach where we gathered allies together who share some of our concerns about Chinese mercantilism, would have involved bringing cases at the World Trade Organization, would have involved actually pursuing the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which was a kind of way of anchoring a large part of the Pacific Rim in an economic model that was friendlier to the United States than to China. But of course, Trump did none of that, and he went the opposite direction on all of that. Instead, we got basically a kind of spastic bouts of protectionism with no clear objectives in mind, and we've ended up getting, I think, very, very little for our trouble, just as we got very, very little out of the renegotiation of NAFTA. We just got basically NAFTA with a coat of uglier paint.
You wrote about the Fed cut. I'm going to get back to Bernie Sanders in just a minute, but you wrote about the Fed cut this week, which was designed to calm the markets. Didn't really seem to have that effect the day that it was issued, and this is in response to the coronavirus. So this is a half percentage point cut to the rate. First time they've done an emergency rate or something that big since 2008. Was that a good move?
Yeah. So the markets, first of all, they can't be totally protected from the impact of coronavirus. The coronavirus is going to do some damage to the world economy and to the U.S. economy. We don't know exactly how much, but we know that, there's going to be less travel, less tourism, fewer conferences. Maybe people are going to go out to restaurants less. We know that there will be some kind of hit of that type, and there's nothing the Federal Reserve can do to prevent that from happening. What it can keep from happening is a kind of financial panic that sort of starts from that supply side problem and then takes on a life of its own. And we saw some signs that such a thing was happening. So if it was just the impact on supply chains or the impact on travel, then you'd expect prices to go up. But what we were seeing was the market indicators of inflation expectations were falling, which were suggesting that there was going to be that kind of demand side panic. I think that the Fed rightly stepped in to ameliorate that. And it's true the markets kept falling, but I think the markets were pricing in over the last 3 or 4 days that the Fed was going to take action. And if the Fed hadn't done it, I think you would have seen a more dramatic sell-off.
Okay, so here's a critique from the New York Times on all of this, saying lower rates will do nothing to address the root cause of potential economic distress, namely supply disruptions and halted economic activity because of the coronavirus. And it comes as the Fed is already low on firepower to offset an economic slump because of perpetually low interest rates. and the evidence that the overall economy is already suffering because of the virus is thin to non-existent. There hasn't been so much as a single week of elevated claims for jobless benefits, for example, but usually an early warning sign. And the action comes after a week of plunging stock prices and public pressure for the cuts from President Trump. That means by taking the action, the Fed creates at least the appearance that it's reacting to the latest market sell-off or to presidential pressure. So there is a downside potential, particularly if you do have a severe economic slump. Hasn't the Fed prematurely shot its ammunition?
So I think it would have been a mistake to wait for increased unemployment, that would have meant waiting until too much damage had been done and too much damage was unavoidable. I think that in addition, it wasn't just a matter of stocks and presidential pressure. As I said, you had the inflation expectations dropping, you had an inverted yield curve, you had the Fed futures markets suggesting that interest rates, next year were going to be lower, suggesting that the Fed was getting behind the curve. As for the question of whether you're running out of ammunition, I think that just misconceives the problem, that when you have expectations of growth falling, when you have concerns that the Fed is not going to respond prudently and expansively enough to that, then market interest rates fall and you end up having less room to maneuver.
Okay. No, I understand that. And of course, the stock market popped back. And do you think that it was because of the Biden wins in the primary?
I suspect it wasn't. My sense of it is that those of us who are political pundits tend to overemphasize those sorts of factors, and also that the market is expecting a Trump victory this fall.
So let's talk about the presidential election again. And I hate to pour any cold water on all of the irrational exuberance from Super Tuesday, but somebody reminded me that 4 years ago, Hillary Clinton came out of Super Tuesday with victories pretty much like Joe Biden had been, but she was ahead by more than 200 delegates. And, and Biden's in good shape, but he's not ahead by 200 delegate votes. And Sanders continued the fight, and it was a brutal slog for months and months and months. So every indication is after this that the Bernie bros are going to double down in terms of the negative attacks on Joe Biden. The vitriol doesn't seem to be abating in any way. If Elizabeth Warren, drops out and endorses, Bernie Sanders, which is certainly possible. She hasn't done it yet, right? I mean, just looking around.
Not that I know of.
In the last 10 seconds, she hasn't done it. That's right. Part of the problem of doing these things. It's just, it could have just happened. That's going to make the race that much tougher. So we're not done with Bernie yet. And I guess the question is, for you and I are old enough to remember the failures of socialism and understand the moral impact of defending regimes like Castro and the Soviet Union. Do voters remember that? Do they understand the particular unique toxicity of what Bernie Sanders has done and apparently continues to do now?
Well, socialism is certainly, as a label, less popular among older people than among younger people. And in the Democratic primary so far, younger voters have been more pro-Sanders, which is probably linked. And I suspect that people who have the memory of what, sort of actually existing socialism was like when it was kind of a live option in the world, that experience has something to do with the revulsion against socialism. In terms of what the future primaries have in store for us, I wouldn't totally count Sanders out. I would say that if Biden continues to perform at the level that he has been over the last few days with voters, he's on track to winning the nomination. And he could perform better, right? Bloomberg has got a decent percentage in a lot of those states. Presumably that will dwindle. And you do also reach another point. So I always have thought that one of the reasons why the 2016 Republican primaries wrapped up the way they did in Indiana is that at a certain point, Republican voters decided they wanted it over. They didn't want a big, bitter fight all the way to the convention and a contested convention. And so they just decided we're fine with Trump. And I think, you know, who knows, but that could happen in the case of Biden. And if it becomes more of a negative campaign by Sanders against Biden, that could actually accelerate that tendency.
Yeah, no, I think that's exactly the interesting point, because I was listening to some folks over on the Democratic side earlier today, and they were expressing that desire. Like, wouldn't it be great if this could be over, if this could be done, if we could stop having a civil war and we could turn to the general election, you know, maybe in April. Unlikely to happen with the Bernie bros to do it. But you do wonder whether there's going to be a backlash that at this point, if in fact people are going, okay, we can live with Joe Biden. We don't want to do what we did 4 years ago, that there might be much more pushback to the negative campaign that Bernie's going to be waging.
Yeah. I mean, I think in a way, this is connected to the decline in serious primary challenges to incumbent presidents. In our age, it's just a function of the increased partisanship of our country, that people don't want to take the risk of weakening their party going into an election. And so maybe you don't support challenges, even if you're unhappy with an incumbent. And if you've got somebody who seems like he's the clear front runner, at a certain point, you just decide, okay, we've got to protect that person.
Do you think that Bernie Sanders could win a general election against Donald Trump?
Could, yes. But not the way I would bet. You know, we'd need to know, I think, to have a better sense of it, what the economy is looking like in the fall or in the late summer. I do think Sanders has some very, very serious weaknesses on specific issues and on, sort of the overall positioning. But, you know, Trump is, first of all, if you're the major party nominee, particularly these days, you have a pretty high floor that you start with. You know, a low ceiling, but a high floor. So it's certainly possible that you win the election. And then Trump has been an unpopular president. I mean, the number over the last 3-4 months, there was a period where it ticked up, really coinciding with impeachment and the Democratic primary starting. But he is a beatable incumbent.
See, this is where I guess we have a different point of view. Because, I mean, I do think he's a beatable incumbent. I cannot imagine the Bernie Sanders victory, especially when you drop all the Oppo research on him. He's such a flawed candidate. He's got so much there. And yes, it's true that nobody thought that Donald Trump could be elected, but simply because you were wrong once doesn't mean that we've repealed the law of gravity. I've said this before. And Donald Trump, in many ways, was, at least his major policies were not outside the mainstream of American politics. I think his racism, his treatment of women, and some of the xenophobia was definitely outside the mainstream. Bernie Sanders, I mean, on one issue after another, you know, just to sort of like pick from the menu of what would be the headshot issue, you know, yes, we're going to provide free health care to illegal immigrants. How's that going to play in northern Wisconsin? Banning fracking, you know, how does that play in Pennsylvania? Taking away, banning all private health insurance, which is basically would kill you everywhere, not to mention the $60 trillion in increased government spending. I mean,
And you can keep going, right? So there's getting rid of Medicare Advantage, which hits senior citizens. The fact that he wants a 50% reduction in the prison population in the United States, which you can't get unless you release a lot of murderers and rapists. You know, marijuana offenses are not going to get you there. And I suspect the Trump campaign would be able to capitalize on that issue. So yeah, I mean, there are a lot of reasons I would not vote. I would not bet on Sanders winning the election. I also wouldn't vote for him. But I would just say, There's always a chance, and one of the reasons why I think it is a good thing that the Democrats are now less likely to nominate him is that that chance is so much reduced.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. Anytime you have a major presidential candidate, there's always that possibility out there. It's just with Bernie Sanders, the ads just write themselves. It just they so easily.
The other thing is, this is a pretty good economy, right? I mean,
well, it is.
You know, maybe the bottom will fall out between now and November, but you know, people are reasonably happy. It's an odd time to be running on the need for revolution.
No, and that was, yeah, there's so much uncertainty now. It is hard to say, but let's assume that the economy stays as strong as it is. And people's 401ks, in some ways, the anxiety about the 401k in the last couple of weeks, you know, returns the focus to it, which again, you have to ask yourself, are people in the mood, even people who are critical of Donald Trump, are they in the mood to roll the dice on the future of their retirement fund? And I don't know many people, in fact, who are at the moment.
Yeah, that's right. You know, I do think that, you know, if you remember George W. Bush during his presidency from 9/11 till the end of his second term, his approval rating was almost a straight line downwards with one exception, the exception being when John Kerry was the Democratic nominee to defeat him. That's when Bush's numbers ticked up. And I do think that you know, Trump is going to, or sort of already has and will benefit from the flaws of the opposition, because a lot of people who are looking at him in a vacuum and thinking of all the things they dislike about him will maybe say, yeah, but, you know, overall my 401k has been pretty good.
So looking back now, what was the net effect on Trump of the whole impeachment process? I remember writing several times, you know, by May, people are going to forget about the impeachment process altogether. It's just not going to even, you know, register. You know, by May, it will be ancient history. I was wrong, because it's already ancient history by March.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think in the end, it's not going to be a huge factor, just as the 98-99 impeachment was not a huge factor in the 2000 election, in the sense of being front of mind for voters. But I do think if you run the counterfactual, what if the Democrats had not gone ahead with impeachment? I think they would have had, a demoralized base, a bigger problem with the grassroots of the party being sickened by the party's politicians in an unhealthy way. And B, I do think that if one assumes that the fall campaign, whoever the Democratic nominee is going to be running against Trump as corrupt and unfit for office, that critique is going to be a big part of the campaign. I do think that it's harder to make that case if you haven't, with a Democratic House, tried to impeach him. You know, I think at that point there's a certain kind of like, I mean, if you're Donald Trump in that debate, you can say, look, nobody, this is just rhetoric. If you guys actually believe this, you would have impeached me.
No, I agree with you on that. And also there's kind of this, the fundamental point of what is your constitutional responsibility? Are you willing to accept this behavior? And I do think that there are legitimate concerns about the way the president is abusing his power. And as if you don't do something, then you move that window again of what is acceptable. Because, I mean, long term, one of the issues that I think we're going to have to wrestle with as a country is how much power we have devolved into the presidency. I mean, I would like to think that Democrats have had this sense that, oh my gosh, you know, maybe we have concentrated too much power in Washington and too much power in the imperial presidency. I know for a fact that, you know, once they get in power, they will forget about those qualms completely. But it has been kind of a shock to realize what the president is able to do unilaterally, and how weak Congress is in its oversight responsibilities and in the checks and balances.
Right, and how much we've all depended on norms, which are being shredded left and right these days. I mean, I think one of the things that has become pretty clear is that impeachment is itself a pretty weak check on the presidency, that, you know, the founders got a lot right, were very wise and far-sighted, but the development of the modern party system was something they didn't really foresee or want. And when you've got it, then impeachment becomes a little bit of a paper tiger. It's only once in American history, under highly unusual circumstances, has this provision of the Constitution actually resulted in the removal of a president. All of which suggests that the urgency of reducing the power of the president is higher.
You know, this thing about we've talked about this frequently on the podcast, the reliance on norms, the honor system that that our system of government really relies on, that a lot of us, you know, had thought that there were more statutory constraints on what the president can do, but the whole system is really based on the assumption that you would have an honorable person who was invested in that much power, and that they would not, you know, that they would not abuse the norms in the way that they're being abused right now. And so, I mean, I think this is one of those issues that, you know, if it turns out that the president is effectively above the law because impeachment is not a check, well, that does expose a flaw in our constitutional system. And even though, you know, we always talk about the wisdom of the founders, really, you know, under our constitutional system, the president, if he's got one third plus one members of the Senate who are willing to ratify anything he does, has tremendous mm-hmm. power that frankly, it seems incompatible with a Republican form of government.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember. It was somebody in the 19th century, late 19th century, who said, you know, the Constitution's not a machine that goes of itself. I mean, it does presuppose some public virtue, and I would say not just on the part of public officials, but on the part of the electorate as well, which is supposed to, you know, have a concern for these sorts of issues and penalize officials who don't display it, right? I mean, that's sort of the fundamental check that is always supposed to be kind of our backstop in American government. And, you know, you do have to wonder at whether that is still there.
So in a week like this, when we're all focused on the presidential election, I'm always concerned because you and I were talking about this right before we started the podcast. You get all focused on the primary election, and I always keep in the back of my mind, so what are we missing? What on Earth 2.0 would be a big story that we're not even talking about? Is there something else that we should be keeping our eye on that we haven't talked about? We've talked about the Fed. We've touched on the coronavirus. We've talked about the economy. Is there something else going on here that you're looking at that we should not overlook at the moment?
You know, it's so easy to get tunnel vision.
I know.
right now. I would just say, you know, we've touched on the coronavirus, and other people are focusing a great deal on it. But, you know, the range of potential impacts is extremely wide. And we just, you know, we don't know what it's going to look like. And you hear widely varying assessments of the mortality rate and how high the incidence of it's going to be as well.
What about the deal with the Taliban? Again, on Earth 2.0, yeah, that would be kind of a big deal. And I imagine a lot of Americans are a little bit torn. They want to end this endless war. Although the more I read about the deal, the shakier it is. I mean, it's a bad deal, and it doesn't appear to be that enforceable. You have any take on that?
Yeah, I mean, it does look like a bad deal from what I have read, but it also looks like it might not hold. Like it, you know, it might collapse. But you do have that question of sort of what's the alternative, and is the alternative, you know, 8,600 troops staying sort of indefinitely, and maybe in a way we're too freaked out about that possibility. I mean, it does imply casualties, but, you know, the question is sort of, does it stave off other casualties?
And I keep, you know, thinking about if Barack Obama was doing some of the things that Trump is doing, what would Republicans be saying? Imagine if Barack Obama had picked up the phone and talked with the Taliban leader, or was talking about releasing 5,000 Taliban fighters we know. But you know the freakiest thing about it?
And what would the Democrats be saying?
Oh my gosh, yes. Yeah. But you know the freakiest thing about this? The single freakiest thing? Do you watch Homeland?
I used to.
Okay, yes. Season 8 of Homeland is based on these peace talks with Afghanistan. And it's like, you got to be kidding me. It's like parallel. It's the whole thing.
So who inspired who is the question, I guess.
I don't know. It's like
who inspired whom, like, to be more precise.
Yeah, Mike Pompeo, does he have like Homeland, you know, on with these watching on Air Force, whatever it is that he flies abroad. But anybody that hasn't seen that, it is talk about ripped from the headlines, but it is almost spooky. So Ramesh, thank you so much for coming in. I appreciate it very, very much.
You're welcome. Always a pleasure.
Ramesh Panuro, who is a senior editor at National Review Magazine and a columnist for Bloomberg Opinion. I'm Charlie Sykes. Thank you for listening to today's Bulwark Podcast. We'll be back tomorrow, and we will do this all over again.